This is the summer Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me begin by asking this. You didn't start out as an archaeologist. You started out as a kid with an interest in small engine repair. How did this get you into archaeology?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was an undergraduate, I had, yes, that's right, as even in my high school days, I would take apart the lawnmower and fix it myself, and when I had a motorcycle in college, I took that all apart and changed the bearings and the rings and all those things. I was just into that. And when I was an undergraduate, I took up some scuba diving, and I read an article in National Geographic about these archaeologists working in the Aegean on an old Roman wine ship, and I was fascinated by the technology, what an engineer would call the elegant technology that they had designed. Very simple things that worked underwater. And if you work near the salt water at all, you know salt water hates technology and it'll eat at your electronics, at your mechanical things. Everything can go wrong. And yet these archaeologists had worked these things out pretty cool. So I went to see them just to find out more about how they did that, how their minds worked to develop these things that were so simple that worked. And they needed a mechanic for the next summer in Turkey. And I said, I can do that. And so I went with them. Turned out I was going to be their assistant photographer also. The photographer didn't show up because of marital problems. So I ended up getting trained to be their photographer for their National Geographic articles that summer and fixing machines. But I became fascinated with what these archaeologists and historians were doing, not so much the archaeology, but how they were able to, these people were pretty high up on the scale, and how they were able to bring in information that people knew from other archaeological digs, that people knew from reading old tablets, and putting it all together with what we were finding right there, and saying, oh, you know, this supports so-and-so's theory, or this changes what we thought about that, right there on the spot that evening, over dinner. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. This is well beyond what I had ever envisioned doing. And then slowly over the next 4 or 5 years, I changed. I was chemical oceanography technician for a while, and that's when we met, and decided to go back to school and become one. I had to learn how to spell archaeology.
Thank you. Yeah. Question from our audience. Your previous study involved a vessel at Boone Island off the southern coast of Maine. Please give a short summary of what you found there. And then it says, not described by Kenneth Roberts.
Ah, not described by Kenneth Roberts. Okay. How many of you know anything about Boone Island so I know what my audience is? Not many. Just a few. Okay. 1710, a British merchant ship, English merchant ship called Nottingham Galley, wrecked there in the middle of the night, well, 9 o'clock at night, in the middle of a storm. If Boone Island is off of York, Maine, it's about 7 miles out to sea, it is nothing but a jumble of rocks. There's not a blade of grass that grows on Boone Island. Now there's a lighthouse. There wasn't one then. And it just gets washed over but in the middle of a storm. Not a kind of place you want to have a shipwreck because you're out of sight of the people on the mainland. Well, they wrecked there in mid-December, and they were on the island. The crew was on that island for almost a month. And so it's mid-December to about mid-January off the coast of Maine. They never got a fire going. They ate mussels raw. They grabbed a gull, ate it raw. And when the carpenter died, they ate him raw. And eventually they were saved. Okay. What did we learn? Unfortunately for us, just underwater, it's all rock. There's no sediment there to protect any artifacts, any part of the ship, from the storms that go. So it's a jumble of rocks on the top of a ledge on top of another ledge. Through the years, we knew there was some cannon down there. The state of Maine is even poorer than the state of New Hampshire, believe it or not. And so everybody just left things there until some people from Massachusetts decided they wanted to steal the cannon. So I got a call from the state saying, can you go save the, you know, so we went down there. All we found were 9 cannon. They had taken one. And some shot, some grenades, some lead shot, no ceramics or glass, all wiped out by storms, just carrying everything away. So what did we learn? We learned that those cannon were made in Sweden. They weren't British cannon at all. So Sweden made the enemy of England's cannon. And three of them were loaded with powder but not shot. And we don't know exactly why. So that's about where things are. And that's another one of those projects that, as I got one more year teaching, and then I've got some research to do on that to take that farther.
Thank you. I'm going to put these two questions together because I've read the book and I know the answers. Everyone else should read the book. So did you find out the name of the actual ship, and do you have any idea where the ship was built?
Yes. And yes, you'll have to read the book. No. Yes, we found out the name of the ship. I'm quite sure. All the evidence points to it being... Should I tell the title or make them read the book? I'll tell you the title. It's Princess Carolina, which is a lovely name, built by Benjamin Austin in Charleston, South Carolina, in 1717. And there's a number of things that tie that together, which I didn't have time to get into today. It took a lot of study to both historical research, the archaeology, zoology from one of Brian's actually former mentors, Ruth Turner down at Harvard, who figured out what kind of shipworms were in the wood, and that was a big clue to us. And also botany of the wood, because even though we're looking at the wood and it kind of looked like the southern live oak, we sent samples at the time to the three best labs in the country, wood labs, and they were not able to really pin down the exact species of the wood because it was so degraded. And it wasn't until just a few years ago that we were able, with scanning electron microscope, there's one scientist who was able to say, yes, this absolutely is live oak. And that all of those things coming together, there could only be one ship that fit.
Another question from the floor. These ships were square rigged, ? Lifting canvas?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Square rigged, yes.
Were they used as slave ships?
Some were. This ship almost definitely wasn't. And you say, how can you say that? Especially since it was built in Charleston and owned by Charleston people for the first couple years. There are records, there are port records, and they would have listed... Now, could they have carried a slave? Could someone have gotten on board with their slave? Yes, but not in trade. Those would have been recorded in those records, and the two voyages it made to Charleston, they were from London, not as if you moved slaves that way, and they would have been recorded, and they're not. After that, the ship's primary owner is an agent in London who was against the trade slave, even in those early days, the early 1700s, and none of his ships were allowed to carry on any part of the slave trade, period. And again, in the limited records I have of that ship, you don't see it, and this fellow was very adamant that his ships would not carry any slave trade. Could they have carried a slave as a passenger? Possibly.
And when will this be on Nova?
The visuals, actually, in part of the recording, since we had almost unlimited money from an archaeologist's point of view, we hired a crew, Sam Lowe, who actually did a lot of Nova series for, what's the Boston station?
WBUR?
Yeah, those
WGBH,
people.
WGBH.
He did the series for Nova, the anthropology series years ago, and I knew him from working with him in Turkey. He came with a crew, and they shot 1,800 feet, I think, of 16-millimeter film and the sound. Now, to give you an idea of the quality, the guy on the camera had an Oscar for doing documentaries, and the sound man had his own Oscar, so we're pretty well covered. We've got really nice footage, but nobody's done anything with it.
In the book, you have a lot of information about the owners and the captains of the ship. What's the process that you use to find that kind of information?
To find out, the historical research is long and complex. We started with Amy Friedlander's work on she had studied the landowners on the lots. If you look at the block that's just inland from this block, there were a number of commercial lots. There's businesses downstairs and then the two upper stairs of people who live in there. And those people each were given a license by the city of New York to extend their land out one block. So you fill that land, it's yours. head out toward deep water, and you have to put in a street stop. They had to have worked together to put this ship in, because the ship goes right across 8 lots. But there's nothing in any of the three out of their 12 records still exist, and not a mention of a ship. And none of them owned a ship this size. So then I started studying the shipwrecks at the same time, started studying the ships coming and going from the different ports. The British Empire was trying to keep everybody within the empire, trading within the empire, not outside the empire. So they would follow where the ships went. There was a clerk in each port throughout the empire, and they recorded who was coming and going and what they were carrying and when they were built and how, you know, who built them and who owned them and how many men on board, and how many cannon on board, so they could identify each ship carefully. And then every quarter of the year, they would send these reports to London, and clerks there would trace out each ship to make sure they were staying within the empire. Some of those records, not all of them, still exist in London and various other places. So did a lot of that, trying to find ships of the right size and shape that were coming and going, and that helped me narrow things down. Also, spent time in the archives at the Historical Society and the State Archives in Charleston, in Virginia, because the ship went in and out of Virginia, carrying tobacco, New York, Public Record Office, which is now the National Archives in London. Been to Lisbon. We were talking about Lisbon earlier, because the ship also stopped in Madeira, lucky ship, to grab wine on the way back to the colonies. So just touching the iceberg there. The other thing we did is I started reading newspapers from that time period, looking for ships coming and going, seeing if we could find. Because, as I said, a lot of the port records are missing. We have decades where there are no port records for anything because the Brits, they ran out of space over there in their archives. So what do they do? Oh, nobody's looked at these for a few years, burn them, and put in new things. And so I was looking through old newspapers, and those are sketchy. There's a 4-pager from New York and, you know, something from Boston and Philly. Trying to tie everything together, look through genealogies. I could go on for about 2 hours, but that's the basics of it, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Now, our last question. Have you done historic research on archaeological sites involving Native American artifacts? A big project by Kinder Morgan is bringing natural gas through our region, which has been inhabited by Native Americans.
Yes, I have, but only very little, only when I was a student. On the other hand, not only Native American, but European American historic sites have to be considered when any of this happens. I imagine there are federal and state permits necessary. And they require both historical and archaeological research. So typically, if there's an area where there have been Native Americans, the contractors or the permittees have to hire professional, certified, we call them prehistoric archaeologists, even though they're not that old, to go in, and historic archaeologists to go in and to check things out. And typically with prehistoric, they're, you know, they don't have cellar holes there, so they'll do sampling. And they're very good. We've done a couple of things where we go jointly together. And they'll just look over an area and look at their contour maps and say, I bet there was a summer place here. I bet there was a village over there. And they're usually spot on because, you know, they get a feel for where people wanted to live. So they'll check those out. And if they find anything at all, those laws require that funds are there and time for them to do a proper archaeological investigation. So if that pipeline is going to go right through here and they say, wow, that's that old 20th century church or however old this was, they'll have to do a careful excavation, just like they did for this site that I was talking about in New York. So it slows things down, and it costs money, but it's a money-wise, it's a drop in the bucket. It's not even a drop in the bucket.
So it's not going to stop it?
Not going to stop it. It's going to, you know, and they can go around things, too, if they really, it's expensive to go around, but they'll go around. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you again, Warren, for sharing. For sharing your time and expertise with us today. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Daniel Weeks. His speech will be entitled Poor in Democracy: How America is Defaulting on Democracy and the Long Walk to Get It Back. Thank you, Dr. Rees, for a wonderful talk. Now, please join us for more time with our presenter and for some refreshments in the parish hall. These refreshments have been most generally provided by Joe's at the Grove. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank RBC Wealth Management for providing the lovely flowers for today's talk. And I'd also like to thank David Fleming, who did the sound editing for us today.